House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, March 14th, 2011. First item on the agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 3277. And I'd like to call Senator Dingfelder and Representative Kotek, please. I'm sorry. 3295. Close 3277. We're going out of order on the agenda. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3295.
And thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 3295 allows a city to order the immediate cessation of alcoholic beverage sales and other operations at an establishment for up to 72 hours upon the reasonably founded belief that the continuation of sales would constitute an immediate threat to public safety. This has to be related to something that occurred at that incident within 24 hours of the request for the issuance of the order. Further allows the OLCC to place an order restricting activities at a licensed premises if certain conditions exist, and to refuse a license explicitly on the basis of public safety.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak out in support of House Bill 3295 today. You'll be getting a copy of my testimony, a copy of a letter from the chief co-sponsors, Senator Atkinson, Senator Dingfelder, Representative Esquivel, and myself, and then also a copy of a Dash 1 amendment, which I will speak to. So House Bill 3295 creates new tools for local law enforcement and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to protect the public safety. Chief sponsored by legislators from both chambers and from different parts of the state, this bipartisan bill has the support of the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. The issue of OLCC oversight of problem licensees has been a constituent focus of mine since I entered the legislature in 2007. In 2009, the House strongly passed House Bill 3201, a bill co-sponsored by Senator Dingfelder and myself, that sought to provide a preventive mechanism for the OLCC to intervene with establishments that had a history of serious and persistent problems. Opponents of that bill were concerned that good establishments might be unfairly targeted because the language in the bill wasn't specific enough. House Bill 3295 corrects that problem. First, the bill would give local governments the ability to suspend a liquor license for up to 72 hours if a serious incident related to the service of alcohol at the premise occurs and the continuation of operations is an immediate threat to public safety. Second, the bill would provide the OLCC with clearly defined authority to work with a problem licensee before canceling a license. Finally, the bill would require that one of the five members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission have expertise in public safety. This last provision will balance the current designation of an industry representative on the commission to better meet the mandate of the OLCC to address the needs of both the industry and the community. I'd be surprised if anyone in this room were unfamiliar with Club 915, the downtown Portland club that was the location of a fatal shooting on New Year's Eve. What you may not know is that this homicide wasn't the first major incident at this establishment. Last November, a man froze to death after being expelled from Club 915 and subsequently refused re-entry to retrieve his coat. Last September, a non-fatal shooting occurred. In all, Club 915 had 19 major incidents in the year preceding the New Year's Eve fatal shooting. So why were enabling conditions still present at Club 915 that allowed that fatal shooting to occur? Why, after such a chain of violence, evidence of a relationship to gang activity, and a potential threat of retaliation, was Club 915 able to open its doors the very next night? Why did it take 6 days before the OLCC was able to close the establishment after the Portland Police Bureau had requested the order immediately? House Bill 3295 will keep us from having to ask these questions in the future. You should have a copy of the Dash 1 amendment before you. The amendment responds to some concerns that have come to us since the bill was introduced. Primarily, the Dash 1 amendment clarifies that only the local governing body or the chief of police or the officer in charge of a law enforcement agency serving a city, because not everybody has a chief of police, they alone would have the authority to implement the temporary suspension that is permitted in Section 2 of the bill. We had heard some concerns that we didn't want line officers making that choice. This clearly would state that it's the chief of police or the local governing body. Secondly, the amendment removes the unlawful manufacture of delivery of illegal drugs from the list of offenses in Section 2 because it didn't seem to fit with the immediate risk to safety inherent in the preceding offenses. In conclusion, most liquor establishments in our state are good actors, they're good neighbors, good contributors to their communities. This bill will make it easier for these businesses to operate without being impacted by the bad reputations and the potential dangers of problem establishments in their area. This bill is really important to my district. Every city in Oregon has problem establishments, bars or taverns that everyone in the community could identify as a threat to public safety. We all know them, we all see them, and with this bill, we can better combat them. Thank you for your time and your consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Vice Co-Chairs. I'm Senator Jackie Dingfelder, Senate District 23, and I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and also thank the hard work of the bipartisan bicameral effort, as you can see in front of you. We've been working together on this for quite a while. As you've heard, Representative Kotek and I had a bill before this legislative body last session, so what you see now before you is a product of working on some of the issues that we heard, some of the concerns that we heard, and bringing you back, hopefully, a better, more comprehensive package. I just want to highlight two of the elements that Representative Kotek talked about. One of the concerns that this bill addresses is the need for intermediate action, and I can't emphasize enough how this is a problem in many of our districts, particularly the city of Portland. But you're going to hear today from some of the police chiefs who are sitting behind us about why this is important, not just in Portland, but in jurisdictions throughout the state. And I think you're also going to hear from Representative Esquivel on that as well. But through our conversations with neighbors and local law enforcement and others, we've heard loud and clear the need for OLCC to take action before problems escalate to a serious and dangerous level. As you've heard already from Representative Kotek, often it gets to the point where it's too late, and we have documented many instances where that's been the case. In other words, taking a bar's license can't be the only option, and instead this bill allows intermediate steps to be taken before a business loses its ability to serve liquor. What we want to see happen is that OLCC works with a problem at bar or tavern to get it back on track. We believe giving OLCC the ability to restrict activities at a problem liquor establishment is simply a tool that can be used before problems reach a level where a license may be taken away. And again, you're going to hear from law enforcement officers directly on this issue. I would like to focus on the final part of this bill and just to highlight why that's in front of you. We've heard from constituents, and I can tell you that one of the concerns is about the representation on OLCC's commission. Many of us who have been working on this bill feel it's imbalanced because on the five-member commission, there's only one seat that's specifically designated from representation for a particular area, and that one seat is designated for a member from the alcohol industry. So what we're proposing and what's in front of you is a more balanced perspective on the commission, and we need to have a seat, we believe, that's designated for someone with expertise in law enforcement or public safety. That would be just two out of the five. The other three are still at large members, but we think that since OLCC deals with a lot of enforcement issues, it would be helpful to have somebody with a public safety perspective on the commission. Only by having this balance, we can ensure fairness to the whole community. So with that, I will hand it off to our chief co-sponsor, Representative Esquivel. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thanks for hearing this. I want to go back a little bit because we've been through this before. Representative Esquivel from District 6.
I thought you looked familiar.
We've been through this before. We've tried to discuss this with OLCC, and I see we're back again. Why are we back again? Well, in my opinion, we do not possess the ability to react in a manner that's fit for your community. We have problem children out there. We all know that. Each and every one of you has one in your community. And it seems like it's a magnet for trouble. And yet, we don't seem to have the ability to counteract that and stop that kind of behavior. But this bill does allow your local police chief and or governing body the ability to do that. Why is it so important? We just talked about a fatality, a shooting. Well, you know, You probably won't stop that at any given time because that could happen at any time. But on the other hand, if you have something that leads up to this, which in this particular case, we have a long time leading up to this with indication that this is a problem, yet we did nothing about it. My question is, where was OLCC? My other concern here is that how can communities reach out and get this taken care of through a bureaucracy that we can have today with OLCC? Because obviously it is not working. We have to come to grips with this, and we have to empower local authority the ability to govern their own cities. And if that includes taking someone's license for a couple of days, then so be it. Maybe if we had done that in Portland, maybe someone would still be alive.
Okay, thank you. Panel, are there any questions? Or committee, any questions from the panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Assistant Chief Eric Hendricks, Teresa Marcheff, and Chief Randy Schoen, please. Go ahead and in the order, Mr. Chair, identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Mr. Cohen, Vice Chairs. My name is Eric Hendricks. I'm the Assistant Chief for the Investigations Branch for the Police here in Portland. And once again, thanks for the opportunity to come down and testify in strong support of House Bill 3295. I've served with the Portland Police Bureau for nearly 25 years. It'll be 25 years next month. Like every police officer, I've seen on many occasions firsthand the impact that violent crime can have on the ability of our citizens to feel safe and secure in their communities. There are currently about 2,700 locations in Portland that are licensed to serve alcoholic beverages. The vast majority of those establishments have very few problems associated with the service of alcohol. However, as in many communities, there are a few establishments that do have problems, significant problems that are a direct threat to public safety. As a police bureau, we can plan for those problems by designating extra resources to our entertainment districts. However, the Portland Police Bureau is a very lean organization, and like most law enforcement agencies across the state, our resources are limited. I'm well aware of the difficulties encountered by law enforcement and the OLCC regulatory staff to address problem locations. In the last 5 months, Portland has seen, unfortunately, two homicides and a number of other violent crimes in and immediately associated with a very small number of licensed premises. The proposed legislation would provide several narrowly tailored tools that would help address the small percentage of bars that lose control of their premises and pose significant risk to the public. When a homicide, attempted homicide, rape, or other serious crime occurs at a location, we have an obligation to the public to ensure that the violence ends and no further incidents occur. An immediate cessation of the liquor license and pause in operations for up to 72 hours is a key to safeguarding against the potential of retaliatory action and further threats to community safety. This option would provide us with a secure means of addressing the issues and allow for collaboration between law enforcement and the OLCC. That collaboration is necessary for the OLCC to make an informed decision regarding any actions that might be needed on their part. The City of Portland, the Police Bureau, and the OLCC have developed a strong partnership throughout the years to efficiently address most issues at problem establishments. However, no tools are currently available to address major issues that may occur at problem premises in a timely manner. An incident on New Year's Eve that resulted in the tragic shooting death of a premises employee is a clear example of our inability as regulatory agencies to adequately address these issues quickly. In this case, the premise where the incident occurred opened for business the following evening. Although management did voluntarily close when asked by the OLCC, they were not required to. Unfortunately, with its current regulations, the OLCC could only issue an immediate suspension 7 days after the murder of the licensee's own security officer. The other valuable component of this legislation is the ability for the OLCC to intervene with a premise before a homicide or other serious crime occurs. There are a small number of businesses that require an abundant amount of regulatory intervention, but law enforcement is often left to deal with these premises on a more informal basis. These methods may not be as effective and timely as is needed. We believe that local law enforcement is in the best position to know and understand whether the continued sale of alcohol at a location will pose an imminent threat to public safety. House Bill 3295 allows for an intermediate and vitally needed immediate step for community safety. That important step could perhaps save businesses, but more importantly, save lives. Thanks for the opportunity to come down today and testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3295. For the record, I am Teresa Marchetti. I'm with the City of Portland's Office of Neighborhood Involvement. I'm the Liquor Licensing Specialist for the City of Portland. I address safety and livability issues that arise out of the sale of alcohol, and I have a very close working relationship with the OLCC and law enforcement, as well as neighborhood associations and community members. I sit on several policy work groups at the OLCC and work very collaboratively with licensees and business districts to promote healthy and safe environments in which alcohol is sold. As you've heard, House Bill 3295 is the product of a long-term collaborative effort to address a very narrow population of licensees, and those are bad actors. OLCC responsible licensees and citizens have consistently expressed concern and frustration at the inability for regulatory action to occur in the face of an immediate threat that arises out of an alcohol establishment or in situations that are fast escalating. Representative Kotek introduced a bill last session to this effect and garnered support of the House, but also raised some concerns about overreaching consequences, and this bill addresses those concerns. Currently, problems have to reach an extremely high level for regulatory action to occur. Often by that point, it's too late, and the damage is already done to both the community and the licensee themselves. To illustrate, a licensed premise in Southeast Portland, for instance, had a very long history of problems, including multiple shots fired incidents and even a rape on premise. The OLCC, under their current tools, was left to try to address the situation in a voluntary capacity with no regulatory teeth. Eventually, after 5 years of history, they were able to issue a ticket of cancellation. In a separate situation, a licensed establishment in Portland's downtown area had multiple incidents that finally escalated one evening to a fight with 200 people within the bar. A responding officer was threatened with a knife. In that situation, 20 other officers were called from around Portland to help clear the location, but it was open the next day. The provisions of this bill would allow the OLCC to intervene to de-escalate these kinds of issues, hopefully leading to healthier businesses and neighborhoods. Additionally, this bill addresses a primary concern and frustration for OLCC staff, local governments, and citizens in defining at what level some action can actually be taken to address problems. Through the recommendation process, both at renewal and licensure, local governments are free to comment if there's been a premise that has had a history of problems involving police. Unfortunately, on many occasions, the current threshold is just too high for OLCC to consider the recommended restrictions or non-renewal. In one instance where a premise was requested to be granted with restrictions, and that was not able to occur, problems escalated to the point where a patron was stabbed. In another instance, a location was the source of multiple illegal drug buys that was verified by the Portland Police Bureau through collaboration with the OLCC, and even then, the OLCC was not able to address it with restrictions under the current guidelines. I hear from other licensees located in close proximity to bad actors who are modifying their operations, who are closing their premises early, who are hiring more security, who are changing the exiting on their premises just because of what's going on at the bar next door or down the road. Residential neighbors often will move if that's a possibility for them in this climate. That's not always an available recourse. House Bill 3295 establishes a reasonable threshold for when problems should be considered by the agency with the authority to address them. Those of you with public safety experience know that police reports are written in about 25 to 30%
of incidents. This is due to resource allocation and also just the really fast-paced nature of a beat officer's job. If an arrest is not made because both parties were at fault in a mutual combat situation or because someone declines to press charges, often a report is not written. When a premise is reaching a level of 12 to 15 documented incidents within a one-year time, this often means that many more incidents have occurred. This highlights the importance of having an individual with public safety experience involved on the commission. To fulfill its dual mandate of both encouraging business and promoting public safety, the OLCC needs a mechanism to be able to intervene early, to address escalating public safety issues, and to avoid public harm. The fact is that the percentage of licensees that would be affected by this proposal is less than 10%, and honestly, that's a generous number. We're talking about a very small subset of licensees within the community of Portland, and I'm sure within the state. But at this point, this subset and their bad behavior reaches a really egregious level for an unacceptable period of time. This leads to definite frustration, but in the worst case scenario, loss of life. Representative Kotek's proposal provides a definitive, easy to understand guideline for licensees and for enforcement agencies, and we hope it will be implemented. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Chief. Chair Barker, committee members. And thanks for this opportunity to speak on behalf of our support of House Bill 3295. My name is Randy Schoen. I'm the Chief of Police for Medford. I also am the Vice President of our county's Public Safety Coordinating Committee. I sit on the Governor's Alcohol Policy Drug Commission. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Chiefs Association. Community safety is the foundation for economic success. And law enforcement is the first responder to tragedies that occur in our cities, whether it's a terrorism, whether it's an active shooter, whether it's an earthquake or downtown violence or violence associated with a bar. It's the police officers that are going to be the first responder that are expected to restore order and to solve the problem. I know there's been some discussion of fears of what could happen should we have the authority to be able to close down bars. And the criteria in 3295 is pretty narrowly crafted in which it would take quite a series of events to allow that to happen. In my over 30 years in law enforcement, I can only think of maybe one time we would actually have used this, but we also haven't had an active shooter in Medford either. It's good to have the tools in place to deal with these events before they happen. We've had frustrations with OLCC when we've had nuisance establishments that compromise the safety of our downtown area, where it has taken sometimes weeks and months and up to a year to get them in compliance or to get their licenses removed. When we're talking about the need to protect the community, we need to be able to move faster than that and be able to have the tools to create an environment to get cooperation and compliance. Most of the time when we have a nuisance bar, when we talk about the restrictions and to talk about the problems, most of them want to comply and want to cooperate for their own economic success. House Bill 3295 provides the tools to help gain that cooperation, but also allow us to shut down to help restore order when it compromises the community safety. In addition, sometimes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission fails to hear the perspective of the local community, especially that of its first responders. I think it's a very important part of this bill to allow a law enforcement representative on the commission so that our voices, concerns, and needs are also heard. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Schaffner.
So, okay, it's a tragic killing in this bar. I'm not a police officer. If you've been cordoned off area.
Mike. Your mic.
Thank you. I mean, I don't know. You can cordon off an area where a crime's been committed. How long can you keep that crime scene under investigation now underneath the laws we currently have?
Chair Barker, Representative, is it Schaffler?
Schaffler,
yeah. Potentially indefinitely, as long as we maintain a crime scene, as long as there's an officer there for the length of time that it takes to collect the evidence and complete the investigation.
Please.
And don't get me wrong, and thank you for your service, by the way. God bless you. So this killing occurred in this bar. You, according to what you just said, if I get this right, you could have kept that closed down indefinitely as long as you, until you were satisfied you got everything you needed out of. So you actually have the ability to keep it closed down for 72 hours now if you so chose under a crime scene investigation areas. Is that accurate or not?
No, sir, it's not.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah.
When, how do you determine when you cordon it off and when you have to leave, and what drives that? What makes that decision? How's that interpreted?
Sure, if I may just give you a practical example. We had another homicide which occurred in a bar in East Portland in late October, and this incident took place inside the bar. We had one person who was shot and killed, and three other people were tragically wounded. It was a big crime scene, a lot of evidence to recover. We fingerprinted literally hundreds of glasses. We were there about 12 hours. And so about 12 hours to process the crime scene. And as we left, the barge owners and management staff were cleaning it up, and it was their intention to reopen that very evening.
Thank you, if I may. And don't get me wrong, I know there's problems out there. And we have, it was said earlier by one of the legislators, we've had this discussion before us ever since I've been here, which is, this is my fifth term. And when I read the existing parts of the statutes that are not going to be changed, you can take, OLCC can take, cancel a license for obtrusive or excessive noise, public drunkenness, fights, altercations, up to and including the licensee maintaining an insanitary establishment. So if it's just dirty, if currently under the law, if I'm reading this accurately, if the place is just dirty, they can cancel their license. Am I reading that accurately?
Yes.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the administrative suspension proceedings, that is one of the factors that they are currently allowed to consider.
And then, if I may, so that's where I think the rub is. It's the administrative paperwork. How long does that, when the department comes up, I'll ask that question.
Okay. The OLCC will be testifying later. Any further questions from the committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, Chiefs, how'd you identify the 72 hours, and are there other states doing something similar to this?
I'm not sure how the 72-hour was, how we came to that number, but I can tell you that when we have tragic events, usually we're on our own for the first 72 hours, and 72 hours seem like a period of time to have minimal impact on an establishment until order and compliance could be restored.
Yeah, Representative Olson, if I may piggyback on what Chief Shane said, and that seems, I think, probably a compromise, is we as the police bureau would want to do a number of things, and the first thing, we'd want to complete our investigation and find out what caused the crime, obviously, and bring the perpetrator or perpetrators into custody, but at the same time, we'd want to get with that bar owner, the management, and come up with a safety plan and find out what transpired, what took place that led to that tragic act, work with that bar owner, and come up with some type of reasonable safety plan so we'd feel secure that the owners of the premise could, or the operators could open up and provide a safe place for their patrons and for the neighbors. And then the third thing would be to work with OLCC to come up with a long-term plan. And I think that's the issue with the current environment is that we have an excellent partnership with OLCC, and we have had for many years. It's just simply a need for timely and quick intervention in a small number of cases.
Representative Nolan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Addressing this also to the chiefs, it sounds like these are pretty extraordinary incidents, ones that we hope communities don't have to face, and when they do face, they're pretty tough. Can you give us your sense of how often you would expect to invoke this authority if the legislature gave it to you?
I believe it would be very rare, and I would say less than once a year for the city the size of Medford, even that.
And Representative Nolan, thank you. Once again, 2,700 licensed establishments, about give or take, in Portland, and that's a big number. Once again, we're talking about a very, very few number of establishments, and an estimate for last year, 2011, we would say six times or fewer is a very good estimate.
If I might follow up.
You may.
Thanks.
We often are asked to make changes in criminal as well as civil law in ways that the proponents of those changes actually hope never actually to have to enforce, because just the possibility of the enforcement is helpful in doing, in achieving the behavior changes that we're looking for. Can you address your professional perspective on the deterrent value of having this kind of authority?
Representative Nolov, I really see this as the hammer of encouragement, if you will. And my hope is that by a nuisance establishment that is violating the criteria set forth in this House bill, to know that law enforcement has the authority to take action should they choose not to comply or cooperate, that would entice them to do so that hammer would never have to be used.
And Representative Nolan, I concur with what Chief Shane's comments, just exactly that is we have an entertainment district in Portland, has a large number of licensed establishments in a very small geographic area. We work very closely with the bar and business owners there in that environment. We meet with them on a regular basis, and anytime we have an incident, we meet with them immediately thereafter to try to find out, drill down into the incident and find out what occurred. Our goal would be to wield that power lightly and do so only in extreme cases. And once again, our motto is when folks are in the entertainment district, we want them to have a good time. We want the business owners to have a successful business. That's a good thing for the city of Portland. It would be something that we would use reluctantly in only a few occasions.
Thanks very much. I'm done.
Thank you. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We had a similar situation in one of the cities in my district, in the city of Fairview, and as the city council worked through the licensing issues, I had several city councilors come to me and say that this was the worst experience of their entire service on the city council. It got ugly, it got political, it was horrific. And so I give you that background to ask you this question, which is, are you sure you want this?
Yeah, Representative Wanda, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chiefs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Call, I think it's Chad Jacobs, Emily Simon, and Susan Pierce. And you can go in any order you'd like, but please identify yourself for the record.
I'll go first.
Okay, thank you, Simon.
My name is Emily Simon, and I want to thank you very much, co-chairs, as well as members of the committee, for having a hearing on House Bill 3295 and for allowing me as a neighbor in the area to testify as to these issues. In my day job, I'm an attorney, and I'm really here as a neighborhood person much more than an attorney. So I have been on the board of the Kearns Neighborhood Association since 2000. The majority of that time, I have been the public safety co-chair and have worked with numerous establishments serving alcohol in attempts to create good neighbor agreements. To give you a sense of what my neighborhood, of what Kearns has been facing, let me describe for you some of the facts about how my neighborhood looks and how many alcohol establishments are in my neighborhood. Kearns is located mostly in inner northeast Portland. Our boundaries are the Willamette River on the west, I-84 on the north, then to 32nd and Stark on the east side when we take a jog at 28th and come back to Burnside. We are a mixed residential commercial neighborhoods. There are apartment buildings and homes. Most of these homes are small homes and marketed towards first-time buyers. The population of Kearns is very young, with many young children and families that live in the neighborhood. In the 2000 census, we had 5,000 people who were living in Kearns. It's estimated that this has not grown that much in the last 10 years as the neighborhood has become more commercial. We also have 60 liquor licenses in Kearns, which comes out to one liquor license for less than every 100 people who live there. Frankly, we are becoming known as the Bermuda Triangle. This influx of licensed premises means that bars, taverns, brew pubs, wine bars are on the same blocks as our homes. In my over 10 years on the Kearns board, since 2006, this problem has caused more and more concerns to our young families seeking to retain often their first home and not have to move out of their own neighborhood. Right now, when a bar or tavern presents a problem to our basic safety and livability, there is nothing that we can do on a proactive basis regarding the establishment's liquor license. When bar patrons repeatedly fight, when there is prostitution, or when groups of patrons are loud and disorderly, leaving the bar late at night and walking or driving through our neighborhood, the most we can do is call law enforcement when the event occurs and, on a proactive basis, try to get a good neighbor agreement from the establishment's owners. Every time we have had a problem, and this has been particularly true since 2006, and it seems to me, based on my role, that it occurs at least three times a year, we seek guidance from the OLCC or the Portland Police Bureau. And every single time, they always try very hard to be helpful and respond to our situation. But every time, it has come down to this. There is nothing we can do. The law does not allow us to proactively restrict someone's license, even if they have been a problem in the past. And every single time they have said to me personally, go and see your legislatures and get them to change the law. Frankly, I am here for that purpose in support of 3295. They have said to us, get them to give us some tools to help you claim back your neighborhood and make it safe for your children. This is what we were told in August 2007 by the then deputy director of the OLCC as we sat in a neighbor's house regarding a tavern that was going in next door to a family with two young children. And this is what we were told by the OLCC and members of the Portland Police Bureau in March of 2010 after a shooting at a tavern in our neighborhood. Well, we are here now, and in recognition of how helpful the police and the OLCC try to be, are asking you to enact House Bill 3295 to give our enforcement personnel the ability to be proactive and help us before someone gets killed or our neighborhoods deteriorate, as places that allow bad behavior only seem to attract more bad behavior. Luckily, the vast majority of the 60 premises are not creating problems, or else what is a volunteer job might well become full-time for me. Toward that end, and in the interest of time, as I know there has been a great deal of focus on Section 2, I'd like to talk about Section 3 of the bill, as we view this section as the recognition that more regulation is needed when the problems don't arise to a shooting or a homicide, but are enough to tear at the quality of our life and make us fear for our children's safety. I'd particularly like to address my comments to Section 2C and 4B. The Neighborhood Association was particularly glad to see this section included as it goes towards the quality of life issues that I have been addressing and that right now we are helpless to fight against. This is the 12 or more incidents of unruly or unlawful behavior section. Our biggest, because they are the most often, frustrations come when a tavern owner is resistant to a good neighbor agreement and the loud, boisterous, sexual, and fighting types of activity repeatedly occur. The OLCC and the Portland Police Bureau currently have little authority to stop this kind of conduct, and this section of the bill gives them and us the authority to do something when licensing comes around again. It gives us the opportunity to do something and that we can keep a meaningful count. Right now, our neighborhood watch groups, we fill out forms, we send them to the police, we make calls, and they always say, bring it up at relicensing. And then at the time of relicensing, there are no set standards for when too much of a problem is too much of a problem. This gives us standards. This gives us something to look at, and frankly would put some teeth into the neighborhood watches that many of our groups do. It would help with that ongoing frustration of, I'm writing all this down, I'm calling the police, nothing is happening, why am I being so involved? Combined with Section 5 that requires a narrowly tailored restriction, for example, an earlier closing time for many taverns would be very helpful. Not allowing them to be open at certain times of the day when children are going back and forth from school, or in one case that we have within Kearns, where the back wall shares a yard with a preschool, would also be very helpful. So there are certain things that could be done on a narrowly tailored basis to respond to the particular problems of the neighborhood. We view this bill as an effort to reflect some of the problems apparently that have been focused on in the past regarding our efforts to attempt to have the legislature respond to what is an ongoing problem in our neighborhood, and one that with more enforcement we are asking you to give to our enforcement personnel so that our neighborhoods can be safer. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Chad Jacobs, and I'm here today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities to testify in support of House Bill 3295. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. You've already heard from the police chiefs and you've heard from neighbors. The League would just like to express its support for this legislation on behalf of the 242 cities that we represent. And while we support the overall legislation, we specifically would like to call out Sections 2 and Section 6. Section 2 is a common sense approach that will give local police officers the ability to address emergency situations, and it's nearly tailored to do just that. It's a common sense approach that we think will give the local police officers, the chiefs of police, and as the Dashwood Amendment say, the chiefs of police and the governing bodies, the city councils, the ability to address those situations when there's the potential for immediate harm. It's nearly tailored because it is limited to those circumstances where it relates to the particular bar in question, and it relates to the serving of alcohol at that bar, and relates to one of these violent crimes. Because of that, we strongly support Section 2. In addition, we strongly support Section 6, which would allow for law enforcement to serve on OLCC. While we certainly respect and recognize the need to have industry representatives on OLCC, we also feel that there is an equal need to have law enforcement on the board as well. So for those reasons, we strongly support this legislation. I won't take much more of your time. I know you've got a lot going on, so thank you for the time to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative
Juan. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just one quick question. Mm-hmm. Have you guys looked at the potential additional exposure that you'll have under your insurance policies if this is enacted? I can just imagine that there's a whole bevy of lawyers just waiting to file suit any time this power is actually used, and it might be a good idea to check that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Representative Wand. It's certainly an issue that we think about, and we work closely with City and County Insurance Services. And as an attorney myself, I recognize exactly what you're saying. But you have to balance those things, and I think the benefits of this legislation outweigh any potential liability that it would create.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Susan Pierce. I always like following Emily Simon because then I can just say what she said. And I would certainly like to do that today. I'd like to make a few more comments. I am a member of the Hosford Abernathy neighborhood, a little bit south of the Kearns neighborhood. Also in Inner Southeast, I'm a member of the Neighborhood Association and a longtime former chair of the Good Neighbor Agreement Committee, also a former member of the City of Portland Liquor License Advisory Group. I'm unable to speak today for the HAND board as a whole because our meeting is tomorrow and we haven't had a chance to discuss this. But I know that others on the board share my thoughts. I believe that Linda Netikoven, our board chair, has sent an email last night or this morning, an emailed letter. She was unable to come along. I want to thank the sponsors of House Bill 3295, especially Representative Kotek, who is a former member of our board. We're very proud of her. And Representative Tamai, who is a neighbor to the south and who has heard our concerns on a number of occasions. This represents something that we've been troubled with and deals at least to some extent with things we've been troubled with for a number of years. So I'm here to say, please move this bill forward. Because Ms. Simon spoke so eloquently, I'm going to skip ahead in some of my notes. I do have here an example of one of the times where we might have used this mechanism with one of the bars in our neighborhood located on Hawthorne Boulevard at roughly 7th Avenue. I have a list of compiled by our neighborhood response team officer of 22 phone calls regarding this bar, beginning at 2:45 in the morning on March 14th of 2009 and continuing through 2009 and including a total of 4 calls occurring on the 9th of January of 2010, occurring beginning at 1:09 in the morning and continuing to 2:30 in the morning. That initial call occurred at a time already there had been reports of shots fired and assaults in the women's restroom. Nothing really happened to bring things to a halt at that time. In September of 2009, crime prevention and perhaps the neighborhood response team officer inspected the premises with the owner to suggest following calls for service and fights happening in and outside the call. Staff suggested many of the same steps that were later built in eventually to an abatement agreement. Problem-solving meetings occurred with the Central East Side Industrial Council and with HAND or Hosford Abernathy Neighborhood, local businesses to discuss concerns, and the time, place, and manner mechanism which Portland has was triggered. I want to skip through. The ultimate result of this, because I don't want to take too much of your time, was an abatement plan. It is, however, our understanding that was signed in February 23rd of 2010. It is, however, our understanding that problems continue at this club. Not many of us who are local citizens are sleeping at the time the problems occur. Even I, a former night shift home health nurse who was out in the middle of the night, don't always see what's going on. Had this been in place, perhaps things could have been stopped much earlier. People expressed concern about even walking down the street past this club in the middle of the night because of the events going on here. Some of our details are a little sketchy toward the end because the crime prevention, the maternity leave by the crime prevention specialist who was following closely. This is an example of where we would like to have put this into place. I think I'll leave it at there unless you have questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. This isn't really a question. I just want to appreciate you coming here today. And I did go to a series of meetings at Southeast Uplift, and we're just hearing a few of the incidents. I mean, there was story after story after story of people in their own homes being assaulted and having their property used and people urinating and other things on their property. I mean, it is a huge problem. We would meet with the police as well as with the OLCC, and their hands were tied about what they could do. And these people have been at this for years, Mr. Chair. So this is a problem that needs to be solved, and I hope that this committee will start that process. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, especially for the citizen involvement. We really appreciate that, Ms. Simon. I know you've done lots of, not just this, but over the years, volunteered a lot of your time, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening.
Chris Linehan and Marianne Schwab. please go ahead, either one who wants to start, and remember to identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Marianne Schwab. I live in the Sunnyside neighborhood, which is inner southeast Portland. We're an 1888 neighborhood and narrow streets, Commonwealth construction, and we have many, many, many issues regarding good neighbor agreements. What I see as an issue here, and by the way, with Susan and with our wonderful the preceding speakers, I too worked well over 5 years on the citywide liquor license advisory committee. We got totally frustrated about the time we set in place, time, place, and manner. We dissolved the committee, and every neighborhood has been working very strong with the Office of Neighborhood Association, and to the credit of Teresa and Catherine Anderson and others for their support to each individual neighborhood regarding these issues outlined in House Bill 3295. What I see as an issue here, this is a yin and yang. All the trouble started with the OLCC when your rules were tweaked in 1999. As long as I don't have a felon of record, I'm new to the state, and I sign a good neighbor agreement signed in good faith, there's no enforcement. I see House Bill 3295 as being a grand step towards enforcement. So as we go down these lists, and I'm looking at Section 4, and it's very, very bleak and gray. Attorneys will challenge this lickety-split. Who's going to judge whether I have good repute and good moral character? Who's going to say whether or not I'm using a controlled substance? Is it a prescription? Is it weed? Is it, am I having something fun in the back room? Who's judging this? And then when I saw that the applicant, the business owner, has to have a license, a bond posted, why aren't they posted to where we can see them, as they are with elevators? Not that they're posted in elevators. I didn't even know that these had bonds or insurances. That was new to me. Also here, the legitimate, the owner of the business to propose license or other person's interest in the business, this is letter B. When the applicant comes in from another state and has been already proved guilty of some of these things in another state, he comes to Oregon with a clean slate. When we challenged this on his application on 35th and Sandy with police officers, with school teachers and others, he withdrew the application, put his wife's name down. That location is next door to one of the best drug and alcohol rehab centers in the Northwest. It used to be a little tiny mom-and-pop Mexican restaurant. They closed at 10 o'clock. You've heard others ahead of me say, why can't they close a little earlier? We in the inner East neighborhood, we've invested our houses here. We've moved here. We have schools here. We have the right to go to sleep and wake up without listening to glasses banging at 2:30 in the morning, cars yelling, cars being keyed, rearview mirrors being cracked and broken. When they find out someone's tracking a 30-day limit with time, place, and manner, all of a sudden your tires are cut. These are just a few things happening in my neighborhood along Belmont, and I hesitate to even tell you how many we have between 34th and 33rd right now. They're in the upstairs, they're in the basement. I mean, they're back behind little coffee shops. They've opened the patio in the back that used to be a delivery driveway. Now the woman that lives behind can't leave her window open in the summer because everybody's smelling smoke. You can't smoke in the business, but you can smoke on the patio. These are serious issues, and I implore you to pass this. And again, who's the enforcer? The OLCC has their hands tied. They had to rubber stamp that 33rd and Sandy business because the law says if you don't have a felon of record, you sign a good neighbor agreement, they just arbitrarily give it to you, regardless of the key testimony given at that hearing. And the last but not least, a reasonable grounds. I'm now on line 11 on page 4. They are a threat to public safety when we have the economics that we have today and more and more people without jobs, and we've got a lot of homeless people that are sleeping in our parks and what have you. This is really a big issue in the summertime as well. So, and then you have another piece here that you're concerned about service being available out of season. I can understand Mount Hood. I can't imagine anybody doing a cognac and then driving down that icy highway to Portland. That does happen. And I can imagine the issues at the beach or along the rivers in Metolius. there are places for this. Portland is unique in that we are the biggest population in the state. We have the most problems, and many of you may not even live near Portland. You've got one or two in your city. So please take care key as to what we tried to say here today. And thank you for letting me tell you what's going on in Belmont.
And thank you again for coming down to testify.
My name is Chris Lenihan. I'm the author of the Little Black Bar Book. I'm also a business owner here in Portland, Oregon. I own four existing establishments in downtown Portland. I'm probably one of the leading nightlife consultants in the country. I've built and established over 100 bars and owned 11. So this is something that's definitely very close to me. And I would like to say that I am a proponent of this bill, of 3295. But I'm a proponent of the focus of what this bill is about. This bill should be tailored to the specific needs that deal with public safety that's detrimental to the lives of the public at large. Not only the customers, but the public within or around the venue. I believe that some of the items that were discussed by the young lady right before me are a little more broad-based and not really what this bill should be about. The drunken public, the lewdness, the public urination, there's no reason why bars should be closed down for that. But the public safety issues that deal with the detrimental life safety issues are the ones that are the most critical in this bill that I do appreciate. And I do feel that the state and the OLCC and the local police departments do not have that hammer. And I'm the one who gets hit with that hammer. A couple things, though. I believe that this bill is addressing the cancer, and it's not addressing the cause. And having owned liquor licenses and bars in multiple states throughout the United States and having done business all over America as not only a consultant but as an owner-operator, I feel that this state is lacking in the restrictions and the costs associated with operating a liquor license venue. It is a great responsibility to serve alcohol. It is a great responsibility to be responsible for patrons. We're the largest drug dealers in America. We are. And alcohol is the number one most abused drug out there. Owners need to be responsible for their patrons from the time that they enter the venue until the time that they're safely home. I feel that what has occurred here in Oregon is that liquor licenses are too cheap. It is far too easy to get a liquor license. And these bills need to start with addressing that first. I'd like to make a couple points. That the smaller issues that were discussed in the bill in sections 4A and B and 2C about noise violations, about drunken publicness, and about the urinating in public, I believe those are already covered under the time, place, manner rules. Those are also addressed by the OLCC. Those are also addressed by local, state, and law enforcement officers who make it very aware to us, and there's lots of paperwork that goes along, but that is part of doing business. That is part of our business. If noise is an issue, that means if there's kids that are running and screaming outside of a toy store, you can basically close down a toy store. Chuck E. Cheese is pretty crazy every once in a while. You know, there's no reason that those particular items should be inside of this bill. This bill should be focused, and it should be set to deliver the ability for the local and state law enforcement agencies to really focus on public safety of a detrimental and life-threatening manner. I personally know the owner of 915, and the owner of 720, and the owner of Cube, and the bars that were discussed. And the reason that we're here today was that the owner of 915, who was made aware over and over and over of the problems and told not if but when something occurs, did not listen to local authorities. And he is the one who made the final decision. He was advised by not only myself but by the security staff. And when they chose to open the second day, the owner that is, that it wasn't him who decided not to open, it was the security guards who refused to show up because of the bad decisions of the owner. The 72-hour period, I feel that this is a healthy regrouping period. It's a time that is fair for a business to regroup, to sit down, and figure out what happened. And one of the things that I would like to address with this is that the particular demographics that are involved in the incidences are 90% of the time ethnic and gang members. And the awareness of having these gang members inside of your venue is something that needs to be really helped and worked with hand-to-hand with the OLCC and the police department, who understood and had warned 915 and Barracuda of the gang members before both of them had a shooting and a death at their venues. The young lady earlier was talking about the liquor licenses and having 6 liquor licenses in the Bermuda Triangle. One thing I'd like to address with this is I personally feel that this is actually a good thing. It is bad for the neighbors, and I am very sorry for the neighbors that live in this neighborhood. But for the assets of the city, state, and local governments to be focused on an area, to have the OLCC to be able to go from venue to venue instead of driving all over Tarnation to handle issues, I believe this is actually a good thing to put the businesses and the liquor license in a focused area. This will help with regulation. This is actually good for regulation. It is good for the authority figures who are able to handle these situations. As an owner of these venues, I believe it is not only common sense, but my responsibility and the responsibility of all the people that work for me to make sure that everybody is safe. That is all. Thank you very much, Mr. Barker, Mr. Hicks.
Any questions from the committee? Please,
Representative Hicks. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Linehan, do you know of any other states that take this same approach or a similar approach as what's being proposed here in this bill today?
I do not. Right now, the way that these particular situations are handled in most states is by the local law enforcement and the regulating bodies, the liquor license agencies, such as in Arizona, Nashville, where I've owned bars, down in Houston. And I believe that one of the main things that they do is they really are not as hands-on as the OLCC. I want you to know the OLCC is one of the most hands-on, and this is the toughest state I have ever owned a bar in. The rules and regulations and how the OLCC is involved in your business here is far, far, far above and beyond how it is in other states. Also, local liquor licenses in other states are far more expensive, up to $300,000. And I have pushed the OLCC over and over again for the last 3 years to raise the price of their liquor licenses from $500 or $402 to $10,000. And then every year after that, they should then have a $500 fee, which would cover the OLCC agents to go out and monitor those venues. If the venues do not have problems, then they should have that $500 fee waived.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
You must have been reading my mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I was wondering, how much is the liquor license in Oregon?
In Oregon, a liquor license is $402. A liquor license in Arizona is $100,000. A liquor license in Montana is up to $300,000. A liquor license in California is $125,000. I feel that the $402 does not even begin to cover the expenses that go along with the license investigation. How do you quantify the license investigation for $400? And is there any loss to a business for $400? That's why we have 2,700 liquor licenses in Oregon, because it's $400.
You answered and asked my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Chalker, do you have...
Yep, just briefly, Mr. Chair. I think I'm sympathetic to the desire of law enforcement to shut a place down for up to 70 hours after someone's been shot in an establishment. I think that's fair. But I have a question about, and I'm not even asking you to answer it, but 12 or more incidents involving unruly or unlawful behavior. The unlawful behavior I can understand, but I have no idea what unruly means. Is that me and my pals drinking beer, yelling too loud at a basketball game or at one another, or lying about fishing too loud? I really, that there's some things in here, there's some really broad words in here that I am concerned about, and I agree with you. I do believe the people walking down the street acting like idiots, these good people know how to deal with them already, and I believe they are, but just want to make sure you, I got it right. The 72-hour shutting a place down after somebody's been murdered in a place, you're supportive of that concept.
That is great. And Representative Schaefer, I am 100% on the same wavelength as you.
Thank you.
I mean, we are in agreement that this bill is designed for the shooting or murder or bludgeoning to death of an individual. And the 72 hours, I believe, is a good cooling period for the bar owner themselves to take a moment, take a pause, and reflect and get legal counsel at this time and get professional advice from the local law enforcement in order to be on understanding of what caused the incident. Representative Schaefer, I 100% agree with you that the bill is too broad in the powers that it delivers. A lot of the stuff that's in this bill is already being addressed on the local level. Trust me, I get hit over the head every single day with a velvet hammer.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, if OLCC will be testifying.
They will be here. Coming up. And I just would tell you, having grown up here, up until the early 70s, OLCC was much more out there and in taking care of business, but they had so much power that it was abused, and then they lost a lot of that power. But they used to really be, I mean, a kid couldn't get a beer in Portland, I mean, unless you had some adult go buy it for you, because places were scared to death. They used to really rain down on anybody that was, you know, any of that kind of stuff, or trouble at the bar, they would stop.
And this is by far the most regulated state I have ever operated in. It is the most difficult environment to operate in simply because of the involvement from the OLCC and the power that the city does have existing. And I want you to know that in other cities, it is not even, it is so far bass-ackwards from here. I mean, the only time a liquor agency or the police department will come down on you is if you have truly serious infractions. And when what I'm talking about now is you have fights. And fights are a public safety issue. Here in Oregon, you know, drunk people are a public safety issue. So, and this is probably one of the only states where somebody who stumbles a little bit is a public safety issue.
Okay, thank you.
Just to be clear, I mean, there has been a lot of reference to fights, murders, kidnapping also is covered as a reason, but we do need to be clear, the bill under the amended version also includes unlawful use of weapon, unlawful possession of firearms, and felon in possession of firearms, so it doesn't have to be a violent episode that would trigger the 72-hour period under the amended version. So I'm not sure if the committee is aware of that right now, but we do need to be aware that we're not just talking fights, we're talking certain other crimes. Okay.
And what I'm here as a proponent of is a focused version of this bill, something that is more specific to what the needs truly are in this business environment. Nobody goes to open up a bar intending to hurt anyone. There's no ill intention. We're all here just to do our best. But stuff happens.
Can I ask one more question? So I understand what you're saying, but we're hearing from people in the neighborhoods, and as I said, I'd gone to a series of meetings, so I'm hearing from people in the neighborhoods. You seem to be saying that there's already a structure in place to take care of those problems. So how would you respond to these people who say, this is ruining my neighborhood, it's keeping me up at night, and I'm having to clean up broken glass and feces on my front yard?
Yeah, in really where we're at here is the problem is we're actually pulling the cow right now. So the issue is the licensing. Where we need to start right now is by changing the licensing. We need to start at where the problem starts, and it is definitely with the OLCC and the licensing department. These venues are not going to be here forever. There's a short shelf life for a bar, especially for a bar that's got problems. 2-3 years tops. You look at any of these bars, and yes, some of them might last 5 years, but really it gets down to if you work directly with the OLCC, and I have a few problem bars of my own. I own a bar named Dirty. All right, it's not a strip club, but it's a 21 to 26, and I have a high amount of incidences at one of my establishment. I work so hard. I have 13 security guards to make sure that I don't have the violent altercations. I make sure that I work directly hand-in-hand with the police department and monitor and regulate my crowd. I think that the police department needs to work and go directly into these establishments. It's one thing for the OLCC to come in, and we do appreciate the OLCC coming in often. But as a bar owner, it is a lot more of a effective tool to have an actual police officer walk in to tell me I'm doing a problem, having a problem with my bar. And I think that the police departments need to be more hands-on in walking in with the OLCC to just say, hey, this is what the problems are.
Just one last thing. I guess with 2,700 licenses in the city of Portland alone, I'm wondering how police officers could hit all of those.
And this is now, here's another thing. In other states, licenses are separated by, there's different types of licenses. So here in Oregon, it's pretty much we have two licenses. You got beer and wine, and you got hard alcohol, all right, which is a full license. So in other cities, what you're supposed to do is you have a 50-50 split on food and alcohol. So there, it says, hey, I'm a restaurant. There's specific licenses that are designed for restaurants. Restaurants are low low consumption rates. They don't have the issues. They don't have the problems. They serve mostly food. It's the bars and nightclub licenses that should be regulated, and that should be a much higher price here in this state. And there is way too many licenses here. And yes, you are absolutely correct, Representative Tomei. It is very difficult for the police department and the local assets to handle all this. That's why licenses should be higher. It would pay for more OLCC agents.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. I have four people signed up to testify now. I don't see an extra chair, but so I'll call the first three: Mike Mills, Duke Tufte, and Kira Thallon. Jeff Klug, I'm supposed to come up and pull one of the other chairs up if you want to grab the next one, Bill. And I want everybody to have a full say. Everybody's had a lot to say before this, but we are kind of crunching for time.
So I understand that. Appreciate it. Chair Barker, co-chairs, I think I was designated to go first. My name is Michael Mills. I'm a lawyer that's been practicing law since 1972 in Salem. I have represented the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association or its predecessor since 1974. I've been a licensee of the OLCC. My main area of practice now is before the OLCC and the Lottery Commissions, and I currently represent many businesses who hold OLCC licenses. I've given testimony to other legislative panels on OLCC-related items, and I have participated in rulemaking hearings for the OLCC. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 3295. As you know, it seeks to delegate some of the authority that the OLCC and the state now have to a city governing bodies or their authorized representative or designee. The authority that is designated from you, the legislature, would allow the city governing body or its designee to order the cessation of alcohol beverages up to 72 hours. We've heard of that. I believe that there are severe constitutional problems with this designation of power and authority from the legislature, basically the state, to cities. I don't believe that the state can delegate, that the city must assume that authority under the local option law. And I refer you to the Oregon Constitution, Article 11. It states the legal voters of every city and town are hereby granted power to enact and amend their municipal charter, etc., and the exclusive power to license, regulate, control, or to suppress or prohibit the sale of intoxicating liquors therein is vested in such municipality. But such municipality shall, within its limits, be subject to the provisions of the local option law. That was passed in 1910. then we have the liquor by the drink constitutional amendment under Article 1, Section 39, which was passed in 1952. That states that the state shall have power to license private clubs, fraternal organizations, basically bars and taverns, for the purpose of selling alcoholic liquor by the drink for consumption on the premises, including mixed drinks and cocktails. However, this power is subject to the following. The right of a local option election exists in the counties and in any incorporated city or town containing a population of at least 500. The Legislative Assembly, you, can prescribe a means and procedure by which the voters of any city may, through a local option election, determine whether to prohibit or permit such power, and that power is the power to license, to regulate alcoholic liquor sale within their city limits. And such procedure shall specifically include that whenever 15% of the registered voters file a petition, that that question, meaning the question of whether power can be assumed or is assumed by the city, is voted upon at the next regular November election. Section 2 of that goes on to say that legislation relating to this matter shall operate uniformly throughout the state, and all individuals shall be treated equally, and all provisions shall be liberally construed for the accomplishment of these purposes. The local option authority given to the cities to, within their borders, decide whether or not they regulate licensed alcoholic beverages is an all or none power, I believe. When you read the Constitution, it refers to such power they can assume or prohibit such power. The cities cannot choose to assume only part of the power to the exclusion of others. I believe that by delegating the ability and the authority to shut down the liquor license privileges of a licensee of the state of Oregon, that you cannot delegate that the city, in fact, under their local option authority and the option given to them under the Constitution, has the authority to assume that power if they want it. And I understand Representative Wan's statement is, do you really want this power? The city of Portland could pass a local option, or with a local option law, could pass legislation within their city that gave them the full power that the OLCC now has within their borders. I defer to the rest of the panel about other portions of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Yes?
I just wanted to know if the witness had a written analysis of the constitutional
issue. I'm not hearing you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do you have a written analysis of your constitutional evaluation?
I can supply one. I don't have one with me.
That'd be appreciated. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Go ahead. Press for time briefly. So, forgive me, right now, currently, you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, that the city of Portland has the ability to make an ordinance to shut down a problem bar for 72 hours if there's murder, or they'd have to put it out as a local option to make this part of their ordinance.
First
is that
of all,
what you're saying?
Chair Barker, co-chairs, and Representative Shelfler, I am saying that the city of Portland, under the local option, has the ability to put on a ballot for a vote of their citizens whether or not they will assume the powers that is now given to the state through OLCC, in whole or in part, or they can't do it in part. They have to do it in whole.
Mr. Chair, okay, that's great, but okay, you're representing the Oregon Restaurant Association today. When they put it on there, I hope you don't come back in this building and ask us to legislatively take away their ability to, preemptively take away their ability to put that on, because that's usually what I hear from business associations. We want to take away their local ability to carve something out. And so I find this an interesting argument. So thank you.
Chair Barker and Representative Shelfler, the reason why you've had opposition in the past with carving out certain things that the city of Portland can do regarding liquor law is that they take a piecemeal part of it and they focus on that. If I believe that under the Constitution, if the city of Portland wanted to pass a law assuming all of the powers of the OLCC within their jurisdiction, including licensing, regulation, et cetera, that they would be able to do so.
And then one more.
One more.
Would they be able to keep all the money, too? Or would we still get our cut of the action at the state level? Yeah, that's an incredible issue.
I think that's an issue I'm not competent to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this need not be addressed now, but if you're going to be submitting written testimony later on, then I'd appreciate, on the subject of the Constitution, 14th Amendment due process considerations as well. I sometimes try and ponder how laws got to be the way they did. And in terms of arguably a liquor license as being a property right and the ability to revoke that, you don't have to certainly address that here today, but if in your written testimony subsequently you'd be inclined to delve into that, I think that would be very helpful.
Chair Barker, Co-Vice Chair Hicks, you mean in the context of HB 3295, the due process considerations?
Yes.
Thank you. I will.
I think you know what I'm asking for.
I think so. Whether or not it violates the due process provision of the Oregon
States
Constitution.
The United States Constitution, 14th Amendment, and indeed Oregon Constitution, same amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Allen, do you want to go next? You can go in any order you want. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Barker, committee members, my name is Duke Tufte. I'm excited to be here today. I'm an attorney at Davis Wright Tremaine in Portland, Oregon. And this issue is very important to me in the sense that I was a bar manager and bartender for a long time, eventually went to law school, and now I exclusively practice in the alcohol regulatory space, Oregon, Washington, and across the country. And I feel like my years behind the bar and managing people in bars and restaurants gives me an interesting perspective on these things, and hopefully insightful, not just interesting. So I'm kind of glad that Michael Mills got all the heavy lifting done, because the constitutional issues were making my head spin a little bit. I'm going to focus a little bit more on the practical considerations. And when I was first reading through this bill, and imagining myself as the licensee, and also imagining myself in your chairs right now having to make a decision about this, I went through and just outlined key points that I'd want to know about if I was making a decision about this. And I had lots of conversations with clients about this, and I'm going to highlight some of their concerns also. So starting with Section 2 on the immediate 72-hour suspension, I heard narrowly tailored a lot, and narrow, and this is another tool for the OLCC, and it may be so, but the word that resonated with me the most today was hammer, because that's what I really feel like this is. It's a sledgehammer, and I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences. To start off, within 24 hours of an incident, it's to have a reasonable basis. Oftentimes, there's not a single police report. Half of the witnesses haven't been even identified. And when you pair that in conjunction with news reports and a lot of misinformation, it's really hard to know when people would have a reasonable basis. And there could be considerable pressure from the media, where you kind of end up fudging the reasonable basis frequently, even if you're trying to do your best and with the best intentions as that individual charged at the city. There's tremendous political pressure, and I'm glad I'm not ever going to be in that position, because it would probably be a very daunting position to find yourself in. For Club 915, I followed that rather closely. I'm not involved in it, but I followed it closely, because it was I have lunch right down the street from that place every day, and I'm in that part of town a lot. And it was, to me, a success story of the OLCC, the city of Portland, and the police quickly gathering information and achieving the result we're trying to get here. I mean, in some ways, a better result, right? Because this is suspended for 72 hours. Within 6 days, they suspended that license, period. And they did that in compliance with the Oregon Constitution, due process, the Oregon laws, and preserved a sense of fairness for the licensee, giving them hearing rights, things that aren't here. So Club 915, really, if you look into what the OLCC did there, it's a success story. And I think that communication and cooperation between the OLCC and cities and local police is laudable, and I think it's something that I would like to see more of and would make this not a necessary tool. Also, in terms of broadness, you kind of read down this list, and it's like murder, kidnapping, assault, rape, horrible things. But you look in the later ones, and it's possession of a firearm, possession of marijuana. And those are things, they're still crimes, and they're still really bad. But think of it from the position of a licensee. People walk into your establishment all the time, right? And if they're going to do something, that's something you can control. You can try to control their behavior and police their actions, but if they're in just possession of something, like a small amount of marijuana or a concealed firearm that's rather small, what's a licensee to do? Are they supposed to search every single person that walks in to make sure that this doesn't get triggered? Because reading this, an immediate threat to public safety is if one of these things occur. So if somebody is in possession of marijuana, that's an immediate threat to public safety, and that city is well within its right to close that establishment for 72 hours. And if that's what you intend, it's okay, but I think you should think that through, because it's not all just murder, rape, and all these other horrible things there. And I'm just going to move, I'll try to move quickly, but I want to just cover each section. In Section 3, this is dealing with the imposition of restrictions. And the first thing I want you to know about restrictions, when the OLCC puts a restriction on a license, it's a very serious thing. And the reason it's a very serious thing is because violation of a restriction on your license is a Category 1 violation. Category 1 violation, no matter what the context is license cancellation. End of story. So when you talk about putting restrictions on licenses, with the current penalty schedule, that's something you should really keep in mind, because when I read through this, you've got code violations. First of all, I'm not sure why the OLCC should be enforcing code violations, but second of all, if you narrowly tailor a restriction, which is comply with the code violations, and then the light is out in the fire escape sign, so you've got a code violation, that license is going to be canceled. That's a license restriction violation. And I'm not sure that's what you're intending, to have the OLCC enforcing code violations unrelated to the sale of service and alcohol, with the end point being it cancels their liquor license. Moving to the next area, it's related to problems and unlawful activity in the area around the establishment, which gets really difficult at times if you're a licensee. Put yourself in a licensee's perspective. You only have so much control. You can't go out and police around the neighborhood. Literally, you can't do that. Moving to subsection C, it talks about the current presence of problems. And generally, the word history shows up a lot. And that's because you're kind of looking back and there's kind of a trend of problems. Here, this change, this kind of addition of a word, current presence of problems, is very significant in the sense that one weekend with several incidences is the current presence of problems. Even if the last 10 years were without problems, the current presence, the window that you're looking at that weekend, you've got license restrictions, a violation of the license restriction, cancellation.
And again, I want you to have full time, but I'd ask you to please condense it because we have two more bills and we're running out of time.
I'll go quicker. I'm from the Midwest, so I talk a little bit slow, so I apologize for that. So just in brief, the subsection 4, the incident counting, I just want you to know that that really robs the OLCC of any kind of discretion or looking at the contextual context of the incidents. And furthermore, it really has a disproportionate impact on larger establishments. Portland's got some great larger venues. Those larger venues are open more hours, more days, and have more people come through them. So when you take this really complicated contextual analysis that the commissioners go through now and the administrative law judges go through now, that really weighs a lot of different things, including the size of the establishment, and you convert that, you transform that into incident tallying. So now they're just basically administrators going one incident, two incident, three incident. It doesn't matter what the venue is. It doesn't matter if it's a mom-and-pop restaurant or the Rose Garden. You count the incidents, and you're done. And that would be a great game, but I don't think it's an effective way to determine who should have a liquor license. Okay, so moving on, and I'll go much quicker through these last two points. So on Section 4, again, some of the same considerations about disproportionate impact on larger establishment, transformation of a really interesting analytical process into incident counting, which I think is really unfair and just is not helpful to how we administer justice in this country, and particularly in Oregon. And when you really start counting this up over the period of a year, you could have one possession of marijuana and one fight in the period of a year, and your license is canceled, which
I don't think I need to add anything to that. And the final thing, you know, I skipped over a lot, but the final thing I'll end with, because I know I want to be respectful of your time here. The commissioners, I'm in front of them a lot, and they do an amazing job, and they're really smart people, and they really weigh a lot of different criteria, and I'm amazed at what they do. And yes, one of those commissioners has to be a representative of the food and beverage alcohol retail industry. And the reason why I think that's really fair is because it's their livelihood, and really, for people that haven't ever waited tables or worked in a restaurant, it's like a black box. You don't really know what goes on inside. And those unique considerations are really key to the deliberative process that allows the commissioners to make sound decisions with full information. And I'm not saying that, you know, public safety and law enforcement issues aren't complicated, but I feel like all of the commissioners, all of them, when I look up there and I'm speaking to them, all of them, that's one of the first things that they're considering. That's near and dear to every one of them, is public safety and law enforcement. And they get a lot of expert testimony, a lot of people that they can rely on in that space. So I feel like starting to have these kind of special interest commissioners is really dangerous. And, you know, final point, it's a slippery slope, because right now it's alcohol beverage retail. Pretty soon the distributors are going to be in here wanting their space on the commissioner. Pretty soon manufacturers, you know, the wineries and the breweries. And then there's going to be other people balancing that out. And pretty soon you have five commissioners that each represent some special interest group, which I'd be very sad if that happened. So I'll close. Hey,
thank you. Why don't you go ahead and go next, sir?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kara Thallon. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I'm going to bring it back to the non-lawyer level here, and I promise to be brief. In my written testimony, I did provide the current tools, the table of restriction and cancellations that I believe that we have to deal with these problem establishments. Instead of going over that line by line, I'm going to leave the details to the experts. But I will say that I do believe we are all trying to accomplish the same thing. We're trying to eliminate the bad actors out there who do not follow the laws or serve responsibly. However, I don't think that this bill accomplishes that. As you've heard from others, the problem does seem to be lack of tools to close these establishments, but more the due process in the Court of Appeals and the lack of collaboration between the local governments and the OLCC. In addition, I do believe there's a lack of communication between the licensee, local government, and OLCC, and I do believe that seems to be the issue. We just heard in a hearing a couple weeks ago that in 2010 there were only 10 negative city recommendations statewide, and with 4,500 on-premise licenses, this is statewide, not just in the city of Portland, and nearly 8,000 total licensees, we're talking about a very small handful of licensees. Not to say that they are not a serious issue with these problem licensees, but that there is a lack of communication somewhere which needs to be worked on so the existing laws can be applied. Additional laws, such as House Bill 3295, will not bridge that communication gap. And to Representative Schaffler's point, in one of the OLCC advisory committees that we were specifically in a couple weeks ago, there was an officer from the city of Portland there, and we asked him how he felt about the 72 hours, and he said that not only did he think that was the reasonable amount of time, but that he has never had anyone who they have asked to close their doors deny that. That they agree that it's a good thing to do for retribution, make sure that it's safe, let the bar kind of get over what serious incident they had, and he's never had anyone say no to the request to close for 72 hours. And all the different committees I sit on, which includes the Time, Place, and Manner Committee in the City of Portland and the OLCC advisory committees, many of them, we seem to go round and round in circles about whose responsibility it is to go after these different establishments with such limited resources. And I do believe that it is a communication and collaboration issue, and I do wish that it was better. But I do think that the current laws we have in place are sufficient. I just think they need to be better communicated and that those groups need to work together to use the tools that they currently have. State agencies are consistently being asked to do more with less, and unfortunately that's not going to change anytime soon. Adding more laws is not going to help the agency or local government process problem establishments. Local governments and OLCC do have the tools available to close and restrict the current problem establishments. passing this legislation will further complicate and the lack of resources that is already there. But we will continue to stand behind our efforts as an industry to find solutions, and will continue to work with interested parties to make sure that the repeat offenders are punished without harming the industry as a whole.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Jeff Plew from Concept Entertainment. I'm a restaurant and bar owner. I've been around for about 25 years. We own and operate about 9 different establishments in Portland. I don't think we need to add any more rules. What we have is in place. I think that, you know, what we have, I think it's in the forefront of it, and not adding more rules, but training the people that are in the industry how to operate these establishments. If you look at the places that have been closed, it just because they close them doesn't mean the crowd doesn't quit going out. They just move from one place to another. I think with proper training and proper doing more background check on some of these individuals before they get liquor license and stuff like that would help our industry and have better operators. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I'm going to have people hold questions because we're running so short. But thank you very much. We have two more people on this bill, Linda Ignowski and Mary Ellen Glenn.
Linda's kindly giving
me. And I'll make one announcement. I'm going to set House Bill 3558 over till tomorrow.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Mary Ellen Glenn. I'm with the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Briefly, you've heard all the arguments about this. We are in favor of this bill. My chair, Attorney General John Kroger, my vice chair, Dr. Bruce Goldberg from DHS, and Representative Tomei, who's also on our commission, is in support of this bill. Briefly, I just want to rebut a couple of the arguments. Legitimate businesses really have nothing to fear from this bill. If you look at how this is tailored, you need to get one or more incidents involving death or serious injury plus 6 incidents involving unruly or unlawful behavior for this to kick in. So that seems like a bar that most bars can reach, if you will. As the law is interpreted now, as Linda will say, the OLCC just does not have enough tools to curb problem behavior at some of their licensees. I'd like to take one moment, put on my citizen's hat, because I've testified before you before as a citizen. Representative Schaffler has seen me before. I live within 4 blocks of about 20 bars and restaurants. For the vast majority of them are fine. We have no problem with them. One of them is a bad actor, and there's very little that we can do about it, we the neighborhood. And this is not public drunkenness and all sorts of bad behavior like that. We get along with that. It's serious violent incidents that we've been able to do nothing about. So I'm asking you as a citizen to move this bill forward because I believe it gives the OLCC a few of the tools that it needs to curb such behaviors. Last, I do want to say from the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission that the OLCC has a myriad of roles. They support legitimate businesses that sell alcohol, and they regulate businesses to sell alcohol, to name a few. There is a representative of the food and alcoholic beverage industry on the commission, and as a reflection of the other primary role in regulation, we strongly believe that a law enforcement presence is necessary on the OLCC, and we hope that you'll take that recommendation quite seriously. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And just one point, my counsel just notified me that 3558 will be rescheduled until Wednesday, not tomorrow. Please go ahead, Linda.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. My name is Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. It's been a long afternoon listening to all this. I need to tell you that our commissioners have not taken a formal stand on this particular bill yet. They will be hearing about this on March 16th. So I haven't submitted any written testimony for you yet because I really can't take a stand for the commission. What I'd like to do is provide you some information. As Representative Schaffler was talking about the unsanitary establishment, you have to realize that many of these criteria have been in the books since 1933. If you go back to look at the original Knox Act when it was created in 1933, there's very similar language that is still here. And perhaps it's time to really evaluate our denial criteria, our cancellation criteria, to really get to the heart of what we can do. We also have 78 years of case precedent that kind of mirrors some of our action. And I appreciate the legislators trying to help us and the support that the people have given the OLCC to try to give us more tools to do our job. I can't tell you how many times we have been frustrated and not being able to move faster, do things quicker, but we have due process that we have to give everyone. We have to make sure when we go forward and do immediate suspensions and we do put our restrictions that we have the legal basis to do it. Because our actions are appealable to the Court of Appeals, and we have to make sure that we're doing the right thing and we have the legal basis to do it. So a lot of these incidents, we'd love to be able to get to say shut it down. We'd love to go walk in and say shut down your business. Unfortunately, that's pretty arbitrary. We have to wait till we get some kind of facts in order to analyze it to make sure we have enough to do an immediate suspension or act on it. And sometimes we don't get that information for 3 to 4 to 5 days, and maybe longer. Especially if it's a criminal investigation, a lot of those reports can't be released to us until the criminal investigation is done. So it ties our hands a little bit too. And I'm not trying to make excuses for OLCC. I'm just trying to put some facts of how our processes have worked. Would we love to be able to work faster and deal with these places? Absolutely. How we do that, I'm not sure if this bill really gets us partway there, but maybe not all the way. One of the concerns that staff has looked at this bill, that just to make the committee aware, it's nice to be able to put restrictions on, but there's no immediacy in this language of this bill. And so we could propose putting restrictions on, and then the licensee would have due process. So they would be able to ask for a hearing to contest the restrictions. We can't impose the restrictions because they're not immediate restrictions, so they would have hearings rights. That could take anywhere from 6 to 9 months to go through the process. So if you're trying to deal with an immediate situation, the restrictions the way they're today are probably not going to get immediate reaction because most people will probably contest the restrictions on those. The one mentioned of the before is about code violations. We're scratching our heads wondering what kind of restriction we would put on a fire code that deals with liquor law. So it's some of those things. I think that the premise and the ideal of it is great, but I just want to make sure you're aware that, and hopefully the expectation of the cities understand too, giving us the authority to put these restrictions on is great. But this is called due process. That's going to delay this whole process down the road, so it's not going to be immediate. I do want to tell you about two things that the commission is working on. We do have in our statutes the ability to put immediate restrictions on when it's a public safety concern. We have done this very, very rarely, if at all. And what I can think of an incident where we have had a place where we're going to impose an immediate restriction, I mean, immediate suspension of the liquor license. The licensee has come in and said, I'll close early, I'll do this, I'll do that, and do this if you won't close me down. And sometimes that seems reasonable. So we'll have imposed as restrictions because they've agreed to those restrictions. But we've done that very rarely. But that the commission does have the authority to do that on those rare public, really serious public safety issues. The other thing that we are right in the midst of rulemaking that I'm hoping the commissioners will pass is enforceable compliance plans. You heard about the city's good neighbor agreements, and that's between the city and the licensee, and the OLCC has not a part of that. But when we have a place that looks like they're having problems, we bring them in and we ask them right now to do a voluntary compliance plan. What are you going to do to stop the problems in your place? And they'll write up something and they'll supposedly follow it. There's no teeth to that. They can choose not to do anything, and we have no recourse. What we've asked the commissioners to do is make it enforceable. So if we write up this compliance plan, they say they're going to do this, this, and this, and they don't do it, we can cite them for a violation, a Category 3 violation, which is a substantial amount of money. So it puts more teeth into it, and I'm hoping the commissioners will pass that. But so we're trying to do something. I mean, I think the commission hears the neighbors. We hear what the community wants. The darn is to try to do our best. We're kind of mirrored in 7-8 years of case precedent and due process and all that stuff. So the premise of this bill, staff doesn't see We appreciate it. There's just some technical things that might be a problem.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chair, I know you're anxious to get on to other bills, but I need to ask one question.
Please.
You identify that OLCC has in the past immediately closed down a facility, and I'd like to know the circumstances behind that.
Chairman Barker, Representative Nolan, we have the ability to what we call an immediate suspension of a liquor license. Immediate is a relative term. We do still have to have documentation.
And excuse me, but I thought I heard you say that you have exercised that authority.
Yes.
And what I'm asking for is the circumstances under which you've exercised that authority.
We did that on Club 915, the one you heard just recently. We were waiting. We heard that happen on the weekend. We went in and asked the licensee to voluntarily close down on the next day. He did. We heard, and we were working and waiting for information from the police to get the facts so we could write the report to substantiate our immediate suspension. We issued that immediate suspension the following, I believe, Thursday or Friday, and he
seven
is still closed.
Later.
So it took about seven days. But we've done that.
That doesn't sound immediate to me, Mr. Co-Chair.
Right.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Oh, I know you don't have time for questions, but I hope we have another hearing on this because I think this is a very important piece of legislation. And I think, Mary Ellen, I'm on the Governor's Commission for Alcohol and Drug Abuse, and I think it would be appropriate to hear from Mr. Kroger about, and I know you're representing him, but it seems to me that that was one of the prime issues for this commission is starting these kinds of restrictions.
Yes, absolutely. Chair Kroger had wanted to, excuse me, Chair Barker, Attorney General Kroger did want to testify, but he was caught up in another hearing.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3295, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3277. And as you're going ahead, Representative Benz and Representative Gilliam, did you want to come up? Or are you on this?
Okay. And Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3277 basically affects a standard of review by which a court can invalidate an administrative rule. Right now, it can only be done if the administrative rule violates the Constitution, exceeds statutory authority, or is adopted without compliance with their own rulemaking procedures. House Bill 3277 would allow the court to declare an administrative rule if it is arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion based on circumstances existing at the time the proceedings are commenced.
Okay, thank you. And as we're short on time, I'm going to try to finish this today, but some of the members are going to have to leave for other committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Cliff Benz, House District 60. And Mr. Chair, there are a number of people who wish to testify, one of whom is Professor Funk, who I'd invite up now if that would be possible.
That'd be fine.
Since he drove down from Portland. The concept underlying this bill is simple enough. It's to add an additional standard to our review of administrative actions. The concept, of course, is that we would have a rationality review, which those of you who are familiar with rulemaking immediately see as a substantive evidence review. And suffice it to say that the concept is to try to prevent state agencies from making irrational rules. That's the concept. Simple enough. I think I'm going to leave it at there. I have to go testify at another meeting at 3 o'clock.
Apologize for the time.
So with that, I thank you very much for hearing this bill.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. I'm sorry you had to stay around so long. Please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is William Funk. I'm the Robert E. Jones Professor of Law at Lewis and Clark Law School. I teach administrative law there. I'm a former chair of the American Bar Association's administrative law section, and I have one of the leading case books in administrative law. I'd like to speak in favor of House Bill 3277, although, as you described it, with one amendment, and that would be to delete the Section 7, I believe it is, that you referred to, that the decision would be made at the time the proceedings began. I'd like to just focus on the idea of rationality review of rulemaking, which Oregon does not have. This bill would put it in. Absent such a provision, it is tantamount to the administrative law of Oregon authorizing agencies to adopt rules that are arbitrary and capricious. There's simply no way under the law to declare them void. Think for a moment what the APA provides with respect to a contested case. A contested case on review the court looks to see whether or not the facts that have been found are based upon information in the record that a reasonable person could make the conclusion that the agency made. If, however, the agency decides to proceed not by contested case proceeding against one person, but against an entire class or larger group of people by rulemaking, then there is no rationality review. So, in fact, the result of Oregon administrative law is that the more people that you regulate, the less rational you have to be. Arbitrary and capricious review, it's true. Arbitrary and capricious review is new to Oregon, but it's not new to administrative law or to state administrative law. The federal system's had arbitrary and capricious review in the APA since 1946. The 1981 model state APA included arbitrary and capricious review as an option for states to consider, and the most recent model state APA that was just adopted last year includes arbitrary and capricious review of rulemaking as a standard way of review. In addition, there are a number of states that have already done this, states as varied as California, Illinois, Wyoming, Iowa, West Virginia, Colorado, as well as Washington and Alaska to our north, all provide for it. Well, what is arbitrary and capricious review? It's a well-developed concept in administrative law. It simply requires that a reasonable person, on the basis of the information before the agency, could have reached the decision the agency reached. It simply requires reasoned decision-making. It is a deferential standard to the agency. What arbitrary and capricious review is not an invitation to courts to second-guess agency decisions any more than substantial evidence review is engaging in second-guessing agency decisions. Arbitrary and capricious review is not a partisan issue. In cases, some cases, industry might think a rule is too strict. In other cases, public interest groups or unions might think the rule is too lax. It's simply a good government standard. And with that, I'd just save your time and ask if you have any questions.
Okay, questions? Representative Krieger. Sorry.
You want to say something about countries? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, you better quit talking. You know, I've been watching these administrative rules clear back from in the 90s when I was on the Board of Forestry. And some of those rules that have come forward in a debate in this room, whether it was controlled by Democrats or Republicans, would never get through the process, but yet we end up with them in administrative rules. And I sometimes shake my head, what were they thinking? What didn't they understand? I think this is going to be a good bill. I got a tree farm, I got forest land, I'm under all kinds of rules, many of which are good and just, others make no sense at all. Would this process you're talking about help address, and do you think it would make bodies, commissions, and boards that adopt administrative rules, knowing this process was here, a little bit more careful about what they adopted as administrative rules?
Co-Chair Krieger, that's exactly the best aspect of any judicial review rule, which is that it sends a signal to an agency not to do the forbidden thing. And so therefore they can avoid judicial review or at least any unfavorable decision by doing the right thing and by requiring them to be able to justify, although the burden would be on the challenger, but the idea that they have to justify their rule on the basis of some facts that they have available to them is the essence of reasoned decision making, and it ought to be at least what we accept from our state agencies.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it. Mr. Wilson, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing AOI. I'll just submit written testimony. We support the bill. We think it's a great, good government bill.
Okay, thank you.
I'll submit written.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association. We support the bill as well, with the caveat that I'd like to get continuing legal education credit for the previous bill, if you don't mind.
That was whole law school.
co-chairs and members of the committee. I am Erica Hagedorn, not Mark Nelson. I grew a little bit here on behalf of the Oregon Metals Industry Council. Good bill should pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great testimony. Appreciate it. That cleared up all the questions. Mr. Adams, Mr. Miller, and Mr. Dobbins.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger and Vice Chairs Hicks and Garrett. My name is Jazz Adams. I'm an attorney in charge in the General Counsel Division of DOJ. Not here to take a position on this bill, but to make a couple of quick points by way of technical input. The first is on the Dash 1 amendments, which provides that the new Section 3D, providing the judicial review of a rule, would be limited to, quote, documents and information available to the agency at the time the rule was adopted. We think the time reference is appropriate, following on Professor Funk's comments. But I'd just like to note that the dictionary definition of available means accessible or obtainable, and hence everything obtainable, including over the Internet, et cetera, would could be considered in a review of the rule. And because of that potential overbreadth problem, we would suggest something along the lines of documents and information submitted to the agency as part of the rulemaking might be a more appropriate and certainly a narrower way to phrase that particular concept. So that's my comment on the Dash 1 amendments. And my second point is simply to, we would concur with Professor Funk that there is a somewhat of a disconnect in reviewing a rule as of the time the proceeding is commenced rather than at the time the rule is adopted. And so we are concerned along those lines. I won't go into it, but we would agree that deletion of Section 7 would resolve that concern. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. This is an bill raises an interesting issue on how best to control agency rulemaking. The Oregon Judicial Department is not taking a position on the policy of whether this is the appropriate approach for that, but we would like to point out a few issues that occurred to us as we looked at the bill. And by the way, Chief Judge Brewer has discussed these issues with Representative Bentz. It is a significant change in the scope of review, might be worthy of study by the Bar's Administrative Law Section, the Oregon Law Commission, Department of Justice. The court has some questions about how to define and apply the arbitrary and capricious standard and the extent to which this may shift legislative policymaking to the courts. We also believe there may be a notable fiscal impact from this, as it will invite additional litigation over agency rules. It will take the court some time and some cases to develop case law on that, to give guidance to the various parties who are interested in that. We'd also like to have you consider viewing this as a package with some of the other legislation that's floating around for land use that would also add workload to the Court of Appeals, and I suspect there will be more bills right now. There's House Bill 2130 on the urban growth boundary, Senate Bill 766 on industrial permitting. I'm sure there'll be more. There'll be more APA bills. The point being that as you add to the court's workload, you may want to consider it in concert with Senate Bill 388, which is a bill the Judicial Department is bringing forward to add a panel to the Court of Appeals. It might be worthwhile to think of all of this as a package and as an integrated part of an economic recovery plan. Finally, if you go forward with this, the courts would appreciate solid legislative history, both in committee and on the floor, with examples or explanations of how you want this to work and how you want the court to go about performing the review without substituting the court's judgment for that of the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, Jeff Dobbins, Willamette University College of Law. One thing that I just wanted to mention, Professor Norman Williams of the university submitted some written testimony as well, and so if he doesn't have time to get up here, I think there was a miscommunication with the two of us on signing up. I simply wanted to say and to reemphasize the fact that this change is deceptively simple as it looks, would work an extremely significant change in the way in which the courts and agencies in the state of Oregon approach the question. questions of administrative law, and I'm concerned about the degree to which that change comes about without some very careful thinking about the relationship between the standard of review, the nature of the record that the agencies both have to develop and then present to the courts, and then finally the question of the relationship between the agencies and this legislature as well. As the members already know, there are already existing mechanisms in law by which the legislature can review rules that are generated by agencies. Rules have to be submitted to the committees, they have to be submitted to legislative council, and there's mechanisms for the legislature to step in and override those decisions. On top of that, I think that it's very important to recognize that this effectively brings into Oregon a federal standard of review, and as Professor Funk points out, it's one that has been in at least some of the model state APAs for a period of time. But in bringing in a federal standard of review, what it doesn't necessarily do is bring along with it the same rules as the federal system has with respect to the generation of a record for the underlying administrative record, and also it doesn't bring along with it the rules that the courts use for interpreting questions of law. In the federal system, the rule is that if you have an ambiguous statute with respect to an administrative matter, then the federal courts will defer to the agency's interpretation of that statute. It gives the agency a huge amount of room to maneuver. However, the federal courts then look much more intensively at what it is that the agencies do within that area of analysis. With respect to the Oregon system, it's in some ways sort of the reverse. In Oregon, because of the methodology under PGE versus Boley, which I expect that some of you have heard over time, but essentially what happens is the Oregon courts will try and figure out ambiguities on their own. And in fact, the idea of deference to agencies is something that's sort of anathema to the courts in Oregon, although it will happen in some circumstances. By contrast, what the Oregon courts take away through the process of a narrower scope of legislative interpretation, it's given with another hand, which is that there isn't this process of rationality review. And so all of these matters are interlinked in very significant and complicated ways. And I would urge the committee to take some careful pause before pressing ahead with this change, because I think that there are significant enough changes that we might regret what ultimately happens, or at least we might be surprised, which I wouldn't want the committee to have happen.
Thank you. Bruce, if the Law Commission was willing to look at this issue and work on it, do we have any way of knowing what type of a time frame we're looking at?
Co-chairs, I don't know the time frame that the Law Commission works under, but I'm sure it wouldn't be for this session. I don't think that it would come that quickly.
My concern is I think something needs to happen. I don't know if we can do it this quick. But we need, I think, to talk. Maybe ask Susan Gravy to contact them, see if they could work on it between now and February.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I would point. I am the executive director of the Oregon Law Commission as well, so
right,
I can actually directly answer your question. I think you're right that it wouldn't happen this session. It's too quick, but it's certainly something that we could give some thought into looking into. And if the committee, the sense of the committee was to try and get something turned around for the next session, we can work in that direction. I would point out that the Law Commission has had two runs at a substantial judicial review provision and revision that occurred in 2001 and 2003. Neither of those made it out of committee. Both of them would have involved substantial changes to the judicial review provisions of Oregon law. There was another bill back in 95 that would have done the same thing that actually passed both houses and was ultimately vetoed by the governor. So there's room there, but there's a lot of discussion and a lot of history that we could draw upon in looking at these issues.
That's probably the direction we'll go. Both Chair Krieger and I like to have things pretty much resolved before we try to move them out, and we'd rather take a little time and get it done right than.
One other little question. Representative Benz has brought this forward. He's looked at it, studied it, been affected by it. Now, can he come over, sit in, or take part in any way watching what's going on?
Absolutely. And, in fact, it's not at all uncommon for us to have members either as actual work group members on particular work groups or to simply have them as advisory members along the way. So we would certainly invite him and any other interested members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that on the Dash 1 amendments, I agree with Mr. Adams. He's identified a problem that I think would be a significant problem regarding documents available to the agency versus documents submitted to the agency.
Thank you. And since we are going to move to professional review, did somebody else want to testify or we'll hold it over? Looks like we're going to move it into an interim kind of thing.
And I guess I'd just ask that the committee considers written testimony, which
okay,
I know
great.
You did
thank
submit.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing and meeting adjourned.